Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than two decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's Upwork.com, Upwork.com.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to five pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Ms. Krause, the next defense witness, please.
Mr. Shapiro.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. We're going to call by video Jack Kowalski. Okay.
Let me... 27.
Told Detective Graham. Is it your contention that everything you told Detective Graham when you met with her back in November of 2016 was not true?
Everything I said to her was true.
And members of the jury, my understanding is this 55-minute ish. And so we'll take a break after that deposition.
Doctor, will you raise your right hand, please? Do you solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give today be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Dr. Revivo, can you please state your name and professional address for the record, please?
Yeah, Gotti A. Revivo. I work at Shirley Ron Ability Lab at 355 East Erie, Chicago, Illinois, 60611.
Just, you know, where you went to college, your degrees, and then where you did your residency, fellowship, things of that nature.
Right. So I went to the University of California, Davis, for an undergraduate degree in exercise physiology. Went to medical school at the Pacific College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific, and then followed by a residency in adult physical medicine rehabilitation here at the Rehab Institute of Chicago, followed by a one-year fellowship in pediatric rehabilitation medicine, followed by employment at Rady Children's Hospital 2002 to 2008, upon my return here to Rehab Institute of Chicago, now known as Shirley Ron Ability Lab, with interests in obviously pediatric rehabilitation medicine and a focus on spasticity management, inpatient, and also chronic pain management.
Talk to me a little bit about your background in pediatrics. I understand you have fellowship training in rehab physiatry. Is that correct?
The fellowship is specific to pediatrics as it pertains to physiatry.
Okay. Is there a difference between, and I know this is probably a somewhat of a general question, but can you just generally outline what, why we have a pediatric fellowship training track for those who are going to be dealing with pediatric patients?
So, you know, the physical medicine rehab residency is a four-year program, including your first year, which is internship. Typically, though, that is adult-based with a few months of pediatric exposure. So for those of us that have an interest in pediatric PM&R, you do a fellowship for further focused training.
As part of your training and your practice back in 2015, 2017, did you have the occasion to treat pediatric complex regional pain syndrome, also known as reflex sympathetic dystrophy?
Yes.
Would you consider yourself an expert in the treatment of complex regional pain syndrome?
Yes.
Okay. Approximately how many cases of pediatric complex regional pain syndrome do you believe you've handled up until the point you encountered Maya in 2015?
Two a year, three a year, by 15, probably like, you know, 30, 40 cases.
Okay. Would that also include some exposure during fellowship?
Yes.
I think I heard you say during that explanation there that your program is physiatry-based and non-injection-mediated. Did I hear that correct?
That's correct. Sorry, one last thing. The other big component of the program is the cognitive behavioral strategy. So, of course, using the cognitive strategies to improve on pain management. So biofeedback, mindfulness, pacing techniques, sleep hygiene, looking at the stressors in the social milieu, whether that's in the home or academics.
In terms of the cognitive side that you just described, is that the same as the term cognitive behavioral therapy?
That's correct.
Since there's been an objection, can you just label what the three standard general modalities are employed at Rehab Institute of Chicago back in 2015 and 2017 for the treatment of pediatric CRPS?
Cognitive behavioral therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy.
Fair enough. And I think you said that there are times where you have involved anesthesia to engage in blocks. Did I hear that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay. And what do you mean when you say a block?
Well, so a couple of my partners there at Lurie's, and again, we're not partners in the sense that we're employed by the same institution, but we work on a lot of the same patients. Mm-hmm. So I'll send these patients, if we're not making headway in reducing the allodynia or hyperalgesia. So typically I will send them to the pediatric pain anesthesiologist to determine whether or not, you know, a centrally mediated block to change the sympathetic overflow in the patient's body, or potentially a specific either nerve root level or nerve peripheral nerve that will desensitize basically or anesthetize the lower extremity. That will then allow my PT and OT group to promote the strategies used to improve on the patient's function.
Approximately how many times have you involved anesthesiology in the treatment of a pediatric CRPS patient at the Rehab Institute of Chicago?
In that time period?
Ever.
Ever?
Yeah.
Maybe directly handful of times, 5, 6.
In those handful of times, do you ever recall any of those anesthesiologists using ketamine to treat complex regional pain syndrome in a pediatric patient?
No.
So I think it's fair to say, doctor, that within pediatric circles, you do not consider ketamine to be a standard of care medication for the treatment of pediatric CRPS?
Correct.
Okay, and why is it that you have that opinion?
It's not, hasn't borne or proven its efficacy. I'll leave that to the anesthesiologist to utilize based on their clinical acumen and whether or not that makes sense in their domain of treatment.
Did I hear you correctly that you do not refer patients to providers that use ketamine to treat pediatric CRPS?
No, I did not say that. What the anesthesiologist the anesthesiologist that I work with at Lurie's, that's not in their treatment on rheumatarium. We've never had that conversation. So,
okay. There. I guess the better way to ask the question is, to your knowledge, the anesthesiologist that you work with in terms of pediatric CRPS, to your knowledge, they don't use ketamine to treat pediatric CRPS?
That's correct.
Okay. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, what was formerly known as Rehab Institute of Chicago. What type of services do you guys offer? Why does your organization exist? That type of thing.
So we're a freestanding rehabilitation hospital that provides service to pediatric patients, to adult patients. We have service lines of care, including inpatient rehabilitation, where patients are admitted typically from another institution, typically acute care. We have a day rehabilitation model where patients are well enough to be in their home setting, but need an intense level of therapeutic milieu. So they may receive some combination of PT, OT, and speech therapy. We also have a large outpatient clientele. So in my specific line of work, I see obviously children with cerebral palsy, spina bifida, traditionally on the outpatient service. We have a large, vibrant inpatient service, primarily made up of kids who've had traumatic injuries, whether it's TBI, spinal cord. And I do see patients in the day rehab milieu as well.
Okay. Did you review anything in preparation for today, doctor?
No.
Did you have an opportunity to review your progress notes that we're attaching as an exhibit?
I did.
Okay. Did you have a chance to review some of the emails that I've attached as exhibit 2 and 3 that we'll talk about a little later?
I did.
Are you familiar with any facilities in the United States that do what's known as a, quote, ketamine coma procedure for the treatment of pediatric CRPS?
No.
Have you ever heard of a Dr. Anthony Kirkpatrick?
No.
Have you ever heard of a Dr. Ashraf Hanna?
No.
Are you familiar with any publications by Dr. Anthony Kirkpatrick and or Dr. Ashraf Hanna in the field of the treatment of pediatric CRPS?
No.
Have you ever heard of a pediatric patient receiving up to 23 milligrams per kilogram per hour of ketamine for the treatment of pediatric CRPS?
No.
I guess my first question for you is, do you recognize what Exhibit 1 is?
Yeah, it would be a consultation that we provided for this patient at Lurie Children's Hospital as they were an inpatient back in 2015.
Okay. And I believe the date of service here was 7/23/15. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is it my understanding that you would have actually personally interacted with Maya Kowalski in preparation of this note?
Correct.
Okay. And Dr. Rojas would have had some involvement as well?
That's correct.
Okay. And so that's Lurie Children's Hospital on July 21, correct?
Correct.
All right. And then it says here in your note, after reviewing records, Maya continues to have low cortisol levels, but a thought not to be related to her symptoms. Do you see that?
I do.
What are you explaining in that portion of your note?
Just the fact that it was reported that she had low cortisol levels.
Okay. Any idea why that was not thought to be related to her symptoms?
No.
Let me ask you this, doctor. Separate and apart from the information in your note or the emails that I sent you, do you have any independent recollection of your interaction with Maya Kowalski or her mother, Beata Kowalski, back in July of 2015?
No.
Well, let's go back with your note here. You know, it says, do you see where it says, today Maya is in pain? Do you see that?
Yes.
Okay. And then... it says, quote, she describes the pain as constant and involving her entire body, including legs, back, head, and arms. Do you see that?
I do.
Is that the type of pain presentation that you would typically associate with the patient with pediatric complex regional pain syndrome?
No.
And why is that?
For the very nature of the definition, it's complex, but it's regional. So typically we'll see patients who present with a limb, so maybe a foot or a leg. I have seen patients that may present with a kind of hemiparesis presentation. So they'll present with a limb and the trunk. But this is a different diagnosis based on what we're saying here, based on my experience.
In your experience in treating pediatric CRPS, have you ever seen a whole body or entire body case of CRPS?
Well, I've seen plenty of patients that come in with whole body pain.
Okay.
The question is that CRPS? So in my, you know, if you want to talk about semantics, complex regional pain syndrome based on the strict criteria is a regional component of the body. Someone who comes in with widespread pain, that's not how I would describe the ICD-10 coding.
And when you say regional, you mean you expect maybe to see it in a patient's leg, but not both legs, torso, arm, and head?
Correct. I have seen patients that, again, no patients potentially follow the textbook, and you have to be creative in medicine. And we've seen patients where they'll start with symptoms that may meet the criteria for CRPS in one limb, and now they're starting to have the same symptoms in another limb. But I have a different definition for someone who comes in with, as we've described in this, entire body pain.
Do you see the description there that says prior to admission, age appropriate, independent, current functional status, she is unable to sit up independently. Mom carries her to wheelchair in order to go to bathroom. Do you see that?
That's correct. I see that.
And did you draw any opinions with Maya Kowalski about what type of care she would need?
Clearly, she's not able to sit up independently.
And my understanding is you would have done a physical examination of Maya Kowalski. Is that correct?
Correct.
I note here in your physical examination, it says, quote, she is moaning and crying without tears. She stops moaning to answer questions. Do you see that?
I do.
What is the clinical significance of including two of those two sentences in a physical examination?
That allows us to create a picture of behavior and presentation.
And what picture of behavior and presentation are you describing here with the entry? She is moaning and crying without tears. She stops moaning to answer questions.
That there's clearly a, you know, behavioral component to her pain. And this is how she's expressing her pain and her grief by presenting in this fashion.
What do you mean by there's a behavioral component to her pain?
So oftentimes patients may not be able to provide, in this instance, we use faces or the Wong-Baker scale. So how do I determine the degree of pain based on some scale? So if we don't get a number, potentially then we can ascribe severity based on behavior, whether it's movement, whether it's verbal, whether it's facial, whether it's, in this case, you know, moaning, crying.
Why is it clinically significant, if at all, that the patient would stop moaning to answer questions?
Well, it's nice to know that she can stop some of that behavior to get some composure to be able to participate in the exam.
And then I think it says down at the end here, refuses examination due to pain. Do you see that? Right after normal muscle bulk, it says refuses examination due to pain.
Correct.
What are you describing in that entry?
Well, it looks like when you look through the components and the systems, as we went through the examination, like under sensation, refuses exam and screams with light touch. So patient did not want to participate in that. And we have to honor that during the assessment. If providing some type of sensory input is creating too much pain for the patient, then we stopped at that point during that sensory component of the exam.
At later on down under musculoskeletal range of motion, you see where it says when asked to wiggle toes, she is able to, but breaks up and screams. Do you see that?
I do.
Okay. What are you describing there in that portion of your musculoskeletal note?
We're getting a sense of, you know, does the patient have active ability to move any extremity, body, whether it's axial spine or the extremities themselves? and what kind of power under their, well, what kind of neurologic function do they have under their own power to move a limb?
And then I, you know, it's a similar question, but you see where it says strength moves UE against gravity, moves LE while in bed, but screams with movement on command. Same question about that passage. What are you describing there?
So the first part of that sentence moves the upper extremities against gravity. So we can see that she's got intact or at least anti-gravity motor function, right? So if you're ascribing a muscle grade on her own, you know, at least 3/5 in the upper extremities. It was also noted on our assessment then that she was able to move her lower extremities. However, when we asked her to do so, you know, obviously there's screaming involved.
And then mobility dependent for all mobility. I think we discussed that earlier. Is that your recognition that she required assistance with getting around?
Correct.
So we've walked through a little bit of your physical examination here, review of systems, et cetera. And then my question was, did you, after your assessment of Maya Kowalski, come up with an impression and recommendation for steps moving forward?
Yes.
What were those?
Well, so the impression as written is that this patient has a central sensitization process that exacerbates her pain and pain amplification with behaviors. You know, the fellow had written a decline in function attributed to conversion disorder. She has signs of pain, catastrophizing, anxiety, kinesiophobia. So again, going back to the physical, that's the behavior scene. We know that mood and anxiety are a component of pain and pain management. And then kinesiophobia, so fear of movement because movement causes pain. We determined that she would benefit from physical and occupational therapy, the psychological components, desensitization, and again, cognitive behavioral therapy. So basically said, look, we've been asked and tasked to consult on this patient and are recommending that, you know, a chronic pain program a la ours may help this patient in her functional recovery.
You pointed out the reference to conversion disorder. Do you see that in the impression recommendation?
I do.
What is being described there by use of the term conversion disorder?
So that's an older term and certainly used back. Sorry.
My apologies. Go ahead, Doc.
So that's a, you know, a term that is a little more antiquated in DSM-5 and clearly moved to something we attribute to or describe as functional neurologic disorder or functional symptom, FNSD, so functional neurologic symptom disorder. But it's basically a collection of disorders that have a basis in organic, you know, pain pathology with significant overlay of anxiety, mood, and psychiatric. So it's, and the old term of conversion is, what is converting? Is that you're getting a psychiatric mediated etiology to and a milieu with organic pathology. So we don't use that term anymore. And granted, we've become more eloquent in our description of patients. And frankly, what I think is interesting here is, again, this patient presents with whole body pain, which really is more akin to an accurate diagnosis of what we call central sensitization. So knowing that the central nervous system, i.e. vis-a-vis, you know, the brain, the prefrontal, frontal cortices, the amygdala, the brainstem not only govern, but they manipulate inputs coming from the peripheral nervous system. And basically you're getting the sensitization or neurosignature of pain. You know, we treat patients from a cognitive behavioral standpoint. Many patients that now come in, and if you look at the literature from Kozlowska, might even say that patients who have fibromyalgia, CRPS, patients that have hypermobile spectrum disorder all have some functional component. Again, that doesn't mean this is psychiatric and factitious, because that's a different whole ball of wax. That's, are you talking about malingering? Are you talking about Munchausen's? We're not doing that today. I think the issue that we describe in our, and a lot of the patients that we treat, is that there is this process of central sensitization that over time, with the exposure of chronic pain, the brain is changing that neurosignature it's receiving from the peripheral nervous system and actually beginning to modulate it. So a patient like this presents with, you know, diffuse pain that she clearly had hyperalgesia. She clearly had allodynia to light touch, you know, is more akin to central sensitization. And you asked me earlier, you know, why isn't this CRPS? And well, couldn't a patient who has whole body pain be CRPS? And absolutely, you know, we've seen patients that have had more than one limb, and that isn't following the textbook. But my experience is pain patients don't follow the textbook. But it's just a continuum of the process, whether the pain is peripheral, right? And it's coming from one, you know, peripheral nerve through the nervous system, getting regulated through the autonomic nervous system. And now you have this upregulation of a signature, a la central sensitization. And so it's just the eloquence in which you use the terminology. You know, so we've moved away from conversion disorder. We don't describe it that way. We talk about functional neurologic disorders. These patients present with motor dysfunction. In this case, this patient, you know, may have difficulty walking or needs total dependence and mobility. Although you can see that based on components in the exam, she demonstrates the ability to actively move an upper and lower extremity. We know that patients may present with other pseudo seizures. I've seen patients who've had altered speech. Those are all functional in origin. And the confluence of organic pathology with psychologic components of stressors, anxiety, mood, alteration, et cetera.
It sounds like we've moved away from using the term conversion disorder in the most recent DSM-5. What about back in 2015, 2016? Was that term being used?
Yes.
Are you critical of anybody in this time frame, 2015, 2016, who uses the term conversion in their medical charting?
No.
And so we talked about your impression and recommendation here in some detail. And I think you said that your recommendation was to do the type of pain program that they could offer at Rehab Institute of Chicago. Did I hear you correctly?
That's correct. That was one of the options. And we also said, obviously, and again, I have no independent recollection of this patient, but clearly she lives out of state. And so, you know, one of the other thoughts was, you know, would she find something that would provide at least the nature of the way we treat our patients with pain, you know, something closer to home in Florida.
And so what, and I know we talked a little bit about the program in general, and some of this may seem repetitious to you, but can you describe the type of program that you were referring Maya Kowalski to in terms of the modalities of treatment that you thought were necessary back in 2015?
So these would be cognitively, behaviorally based. So the core of that is changing the way in which the patient perceives pain, has a relationship with pain, and that's through the cognitive component with the psychologist, using biofeedback skills, mindfulness, using strategies to start to change that conversation around pain, coupled then with the physical and occupational therapy modality seen fit by the provider to optimize, you know, return in function while reducing, you know, pain perception. So we talk about it in this case where she has evidence of pain to light touch, you know, a desensitization process where you're actually trying to change that perception of what inputs are you know, causing centrally that central sensitization process.
Any recommendations for any type of analgesic or pain medication?
Not at this visit.
And I think we talked about it, but your recommendations were for PT, OT, psychology, desensitization, and cognitive behavioral therapy?
Correct.
Okay. At a program such as Rehab Institute of Chicago or a similar facility that could provide that similar panoply of services?
Correct.
All right. And same question for Jennifer Richard. Who is that?
Yeah. So Jennifer Reichert, she was the clinical manager at our Center for Pain Management during this time period.
Okay. And Ms. Reichert was asked some questions about the program at Rehab Institute of Chicago for pediatric CRPS. Have you had a chance to review Ms. Reichert's responses to Beata Kowalski's questions about the program?
Yes.
How do you characterize Ms. Reichert's responses to Ms. Kowalski's questions?
It looks like there were a set of questions that Ms. Kowalski had about, you know, if they're to participate in a program specifically, you know, what type of service do we offer? And she attempted to go through that process of answering those questions.
Based on your review, did it appear as if Reichert responded to these questions in an accurate fashion?
Yes.
It doesn't appear in the emails, but I did have a question about it. At the Rehab Institute of Chicago, do you have any experience with treating pediatric CRPS with the surgical implantation of an intrathecal clonidine pump?
No.
Do you recognize intrathecal clonidine pumps as a standard of care modality for the treatment of pediatric complex regional pain syndrome?
I don't.
In this time frame, January of 2017, if you were asked what type of meds or vitamins do you use for your CRPS patients, what would your answer have been?
We'll typically trial the gabapentinoids, so gabapentin, Lyrica. There have been trials using high-dose vitamin C. You know, and certainly have a discussion with patients and their tolerance for trialing meds. We'll certainly use tricyclic antidepressants to try to change the neuropathic signature. Potentially go deep into the antiepileptics. But that's probably about as far as we'll go. So really, you know, treatment for me specifically is gabapentin, Lyrica, tricyclics, maybe, you know, trialing some of the antiepileptics. And, you know, certainly there's some debate whether vitamin C makes a difference.
What about ketamine?
No.
And why not?
Look, I don't have experience with it. That's not something that we certainly use, and I've certainly not had any patients that frankly have asked about ketamine. So, you know, if they do, I refer them to the adult colleagues down at Rush.
I've heard a lot throughout this case that the standard of care therapy for pediatric CRPS is PT, OT, and cognitive behavioral therapy. Is that a statement you would agree with or disagree with?
I treat a subset of these patients. I would not sit here today and tell you that I treat every kid that has contracted or developed CRPS. You know, we have one philosophical viewpoint on how to treat patients with chronic pain, whether it's CRPS or central sensitization or whatever. And that's the way we treat them. I clearly realize we're in the minority. I'm part of a pain listserv. We're unique in that it's truly physiatric based with cognitive behavioral therapy at the core. Clearly, most practitioners of pediatric pain management are anesthesia based. So we're unique in that matter. I would not say that's our standard of care. I'm not going to speak for the field.
And based on your review of these emails, what was your understanding of the plan of action as of January 2017 as set forth in just in these emails?
I'm actually not sure. It sounds like they were maybe interested in doing the program, and I'm not sure where it got left.
Fair enough. Do you ever recall being contacted by anybody from Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital to discuss Maya Kowalski, her case, or really anything for that matter?
No, not at all.
Same question for a Dr. Sally Smith. She's a pediatric child abuse physician. Do you recall if she ever contacted you?
No.
Okay, what is the Budapest criteria?
So it's a group, and Dr. Norm Harden, who was one of our mentors and colleagues here and director of pain management, provided a construct in which to provide clinicians which a way to better diagnose CRPS and to sift through the other diagnoses where maybe they didn't meet criteria and such. You know, you would have to figure out what the etiology of pain was, because otherwise it's like fibromyalgia was 20 years ago. If you couldn't explain it, everybody had fibromyalgia. And so attempting to become a little more eloquent in the presentation and developing a impression of the patient.
When you're diagnosing a patient or considering diagnosing a patient with CRPS, do you use the Budapest criteria in your clinical work?
Yes.
And why do you use that criteria?
Provides for a better accurate treatment. Obviously, the reality for me is a lot of the procedure, so specifically in CRPS, you know, the therapist may ascribe a very specific philosophical presentation of, you know, providing graded motor imagery and mirror therapy and, you know, attempting to decouple the limb from, you know, this pain presentation. But it's just kind of determine and devise the treatment plan a little more eloquently.
From what I'm reading here from your consult note, you didn't diagnose the patient with CRPS. Is that correct?
That's correct. So yes, in a patient with CRPS, the PT and the OT are going to start in a very different place than maybe FND, or in this case, conversion disorder or central sensitization, and focus on, you know, if she's not moving, how do you get her to start moving and improve on transfers and improve on mobility?
Based on your review of this consult note and your training and experience, why did you not put complex regional pain syndrome, also known as RSD, on Maya Kowalski's differential?
Well, one, the presentation is more diffuse. There isn't a specific, hey, you know, I had some traumatic injury to my extremity, and now I've got pseudomotor changes, vasomotor changes, so I have swelling, I have discoloration, I have a temperature discrepancy between one limb and another. You know, the rest of the body's fine, but please don't touch my right foot, because when you do, you send, you know, electrical shock waves through my body. We're not getting any of that flavor or description in this note. So hence, you know, the fellow at the time put conversion, and perhaps maybe more appropriately, that concept of what I described as central sensitization is more pertinent or relevant based on the presentation.
All right. So because a lay jury may hear this as opposed to specialists in your field, fair to say that your differential at this time was leaning towards central sensitization and not complex regional pain syndrome?
That's correct. And again, I have no recollection of this patient, but I can only go on this one note. Basically, you know, not observing any of the telltale signs of changes in an extremity. In fact, you know, this patient has normal muscle bulk. They're moving the extremities. There's, you know, obviously, whether it's allodynia or hyperalgesia to light touch, you know, I'm not seeing any of the symptomatology of consistent with CRPS.
So, Dr. Revivo, am I doing that correctly?
You are. Thank you.
Dr. Revivo, complex regional pain syndrome is a progressive disease to a certain extent, is it not?
It depends.
Well, you can start out with a few symptoms, but as time goes on, develop several more. Can you not?
You know, in my experience of patients, you certainly have had potentially, you know, the presentation of hyperalgesia and allodynia and maybe the pseudomotor and vasomotor changes. What I've seen is potential spread in the body. As far as morphing symptoms, you know, or additional symptoms, I don't know.
All right. Did you check to see whether she had the beginnings of any CRPS lesions?
I can only go based on what we have in this note, since it's the only visit we had with this patient and what we've documented.
And you are familiar with CRPS lesions, are you not?
Yes.
They're rather distinctive.
That's correct. That's correct.
And if this patient down the road were to develop those lesions, say within the matter of 3-4 months, 6 months after you seeing her, would that have some effect on your ultimate diagnosis?
For sure.
And isn't there now there are 2 or 3 different forms of CRPS, are there not? There's like Roman numeral 1, Roman numeral 2, and Roman numeral 3. I don't know how you turn them.
Well, yeah, I mean, traditionally, you know, there has to be trauma. And whether they're, you know, Roman numeral 1 and 2, at least, the dichotomy between the two is that you have EMG identified nerve damage with type 2.
Okay. And what did you check for to determine if that type of nerve damage was present?
Obviously that would be EMG, but that would be if that was warranted based on the examination at the time. So our exam specifically looked at attempting neurologic assessment of both sensory systems and motor systems. Okay. Sensory systems, obviously, refused exam, screamed with light touch. So she clearly has got at least hyperalgesia, if not allodynia, by definition. Mm-hmm. And based on our examination and what she would, again, just based on what we've described in this note, allow us to do. So we noted right active movement of the upper extremity. We noted intact motor to allowing her to wiggle her toes. So in some part, we were able to assess both a sensory and a motor component on the exam.
And just so the jury is aware, in either one of these, if it's CRPS or it's the diagnosis that you had, these are not diagnoses of being paralyzed, are they?
No, you're right. Typically not paralyzed, no.
Okay. And as we sit here today, I don't think you've had the opportunity to discuss what happened to Maya afterwards, her continued course of treatment throughout the rest of 2015 and into 2016, have you?
No, this is my only visit with the parent and the patient.
And one of the problems in diagnosing these, if I'm reading my literature correctly here, is that many people don't believe the patient, particularly children, that they're in pain because of the way it presents. Is that fair enough to say?
Very fair. And I think that's why I talked about conversion and really moving away from that moniker, as it's maybe even, you know, perceived as pejorative, in that, you know, this functional neurologic symptom disorder, which central sensitization, if you read the literature and you ascribe to certain opinions, you know, may fall under that, in that there is some component of functional change. Because if you state that this patient in some regard has intact motor function, but yet is dependent in mobility, then this pain is very real. And at the same time, there is a functional component, i.e. there is some function that is altered or limited because of pain. But no, I deal with chronic pain patients every day. That whole concept of central sensitization and what Melzack stated as the neurosignature in the neuromatrix is that pain is very real. What's hard to know is that you get a lot of this background noise. So you get behavior. It's difficult to examine a patient like this, but by no means does that mean we don't believe them.
And particularly with, you talked about this, the specialization of pediatrics, it's sometimes difficult, particularly with a child, if you don't know, as you just explained, how this works, it can be easy to misidentify this as a psychiatric or psychological problem, isn't it?
Correct.
Can you describe for the jury the concept of intractable pain in what you do?
I mean, intractable pain would be no relief, right? So we use the FACES scale to try to ascribe a degree of how much pain the patient is perceiving, and the fact that that pain is chronic and unabating.
Your diagnosis was not conversion disorder, true?
Certainly that was, there were components of conversion disorder on our assessment with, you know, an ICD, well, in 2015 would have been ICD-9, but the more eloquent diagnosis today really would be that concept of central sensitization. So, yeah.
And likewise, there were some signs, such as the allodynia or
hyperalgesia.
Hyperalgesia, thank you. Present in Maya as well. And those are CRPS indications, are they not?
They are, but without the other telltale signs, as you stated earlier, I see allodynia, I see hyperalgesia. Well, I see that in other pain diagnoses, like central sensitization, like hypermobile spectrum disorder, like fibromyalgia.
All right, so we're clear then. With your experience, what symptoms would you need, symptoms or signs, combination, would you want to see before you felt confident in a CRPS diagnosis?
Sure. Some degree of asymmetric temperature change. There may be some swelling or edema. There may be discoloration, whether it's purple or red. But you start to see some dysvascular, neurovascular changes in an extremity that are more akin to what we typically see in the traditional patient that presents with a CRPS diagnosis.
And plus the, like you said, the super sensitivity to touch?
Correct.
Allodynia. And then the, and that's kind of like a fear of being touched, is it not?
Well, the kinesiophobia is really the fear of movement or being touched. I mean, allodynia is, you know, you lightly stroke a portion of the body and you're causing, you know, excruciating pain, where you traditionally, that's not a painful stimulation.
But they think it might be, and so they overreact.
Sure.
And then, of course, the lesions eventually. So, the lesions eventually.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, it's patients that are coming have been made, you know, the diagnosis has been made. They're coming with the lesions. They're coming in the CAM boot. They're coming in with the altered mobility, as opposed to, you know, seeing them.
I see. So you're not usually the one coming up with the diagnosis. You're the one treating it once it's been diagnosed. Fair enough.
I mean, you know, we're a tertiary center, chronic pain. These patients traditionally have seen other clinicians, whether the diagnosis is accurate or not. They're, you know, we've had plenty of patients where they state they have CRPS and then we disagree and say, well, you're on a continuum of that neurologically, but you don't meet all the criteria. Or traditionally they've seen, you know, two or three orthopedists, they've been put in a CAM boot and they show up to us and we're like, yeah, okay, you meet the criteria. Now let's treat you. You know, now you're asking about suicidal ideation and, you know, all these other issues that may be related to pain, but that's, we, you know, I did treat at some point, begrudgingly, some of the adults in our program just because of staffing. And we had patients that said, hey, I'm going to go home and kill myself. And we had them sent to the emergency room. We called 911 and said, you know, I can't send you home safely. Sure. Telling me that you have a plan and that you have a means. And those were the adults. I have never had a pediatric patient tell me that.
And so some of the pains with, say, the CRPS, are they a constant or can they go away and come back, reoccur?
It's very interesting because I have a cohort of a couple girls that, you know, by textbook would be given that definition, but then their symptoms and their signs and symptoms veer from textbook and they have symptomatic flares and they're doing well with gabapentin. And, you know, whether it's truly CRPS at this point, or do we change the diagnosis to this concept of central sensitization? They clearly, their bodies haven't read the textbook, you know, but yet we're still treating them as if they had allodynia periodically and hyperalgesia. And yeah, it's a very small subset.
Hey, doctor, a couple follow-ups. This is David Hughes again, counsel for Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. Can you please list your board certifications?
So I'm board certified when we complete PM&R residency in basically, you know, physiatric medicine, and then sub-boarded in pediatric physical medicine. So really have one board. The pediatric board supersedes the adult board, and we basically take an exam every 10 years, and then we're doing longitudinal assessment at this point.
Would you consider yourself an expert in the field of pediatric physical medicine?
Correct, yes.
Okay. There was reference made to hyperbaric oxygen therapy for complex regional pain syndrome. Are you aware of let me ask you this. Do you at Rehab Institute of Chicago employ hyperbaric oxygen therapy for pediatric CRPS?
No.
Have you ever heard of that modality being used for a pediatric CRPS patient?
Yes.
What is your opinion on its efficacy if you have one?
I usually tell families that if they have enormous amounts of money, then certainly they can use it, but the research hasn't borne out practicality, efficacy. We traditionally will use it for patients who have burns and wounds, but I treat a lot of patients with cerebral palsy. Families want to pursue that treatment. If they have endless amounts of money to pursue that, then so be it. But the data doesn't point that out.
Have you ever had a parent come to you at Lurie's or the Rehab Institute of Chicago and ask for their child to be placed in a medically induced ketamine coma down in Mexico?
No.
Have you ever heard of one of your patients going down to Mexico to do that?
No.
Are you familiar with the Dr. Fernando Cantu down in Mexico?
No.
And I think you said you've seen some of these lesions in pediatric CRPS patients before. Is that correct?
I have.
What do these lesions look like in your experience, specifically on pediatric CRPS patients?
I mean, I think to be really specific, you know, these patients, they present with a, you know, let's say, for instance, the leg, There may be a discoloration, maybe somewhere between purple and red. There's temperature differences. There's some swelling. I've had one patient, if you want to say the word lesion, he was an adult. And this is at the time that I'm still seeing adults whose limb basically was black and purple. So, you know, that may be more along the lines of the textbook lesion, but the lesions that we're treating are the signs and symptoms that are more ascribed to, you know, this waxing and waning discoloration of the limb and temperature difference and swelling.
Okay. Let me screen share an image here for you. And I'll represent to you that this is an image of Maya Kowalski taken on, I believe, January 1 of 2017. Its base number is JHACH014768. I'd like to attach this as an exhibit. Do you see what I'm circling here on the right forehead here?
Yes.
Does that appear to you to be consistent with the type of CRPS lesions you've seen in the past?
No.
Why not?
Because it isn't. It looks like a scratch.
Okay. So why does it look like a scratch to you?
Because it does. It doesn't look like it's CRPS. There's no swelling. There's no edema. It's on the forehead.
You mentioned EMG nerve conduction testing in your testimony. You remember bringing that issue up?
I do.
Let me ask you a hypothetical, doctor. Say, for example, 1 month after the Lurie's presentation at issue, Maya Kowalski underwent an EMG at an outside facility, and that was negative. Knowing that, how would that impact your assessment as to whether or not Maya Kowalski did or didn't have CRPS?
Well, I think in fairness, I wouldn't give her a diagnosis of CRPS type 2, but solely based on a negative EMG, that doesn't mean she doesn't have CRPS type 1. Just tells you that there isn't nerve damage.
Would you consider a study where the average female age is 39 and the average male age to be 43 years of old to be a pediatric focused document?
Well,
why not?
Because pediatrics is 0 to 18 years of age.
Fair enough. Have you ever had a parent or anybody for that matter, refer a child with a CRPS diagnosis to hospice?
No.
You saw some characteristic CRPS style skin lesions during your assessment with Maya Kowalski. Do you think that's something that you would have documented in your progress note?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that light comes on really fast, doesn't it? So now that I've blinded you, it's time for your break. Do not discuss this case amongst yourselves. Do not do any investigation and receive no information. Let's try to keep it to about a 10-minute break. It's a thank you note for the birthday.
Oh, nice.
They even drew little balloons and signed the juror number. I don't want to say the juror number, but it's right. The juror number whose birthday is.
That's nice.
Yeah.
They didn't thank you for the unbirthday?
Actually, no. We've got to do something about that. But it does say it brought a smile to all of our faces, so perhaps it's implicit in the note. So, in any event, any issues we need to address before we.
Just a quick discussion, Judge, on timing. Sure. Unfortunately, the next witness we have is another video deposition.
For how long?
That's the really unfortunate comment. It's 2 hours.
Well, okay.
I just wanted to let the court know. Maybe they could stand up and stretch it 1 hour or something.
That's fine. I'll ask them. Anything else?
No,
Ms. Lawrence?
Nothing.
Let's take a 10-minute break. Let's try to keep it at 10 minutes if, in fact, we've got a 2-hour deposition in our immediate future.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
We'll be in recess 10 minutes.
Okay.
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.